Welcome to On Eagle's Wings. Special hello to the greatest audience on the planet. Once again, I appreciate your dedicated support of this show and the wonderful messages that you send, and I am trying hard to catch up with all of you. Apologize for the quality of my voice this week. I am recovering from a little bit of a cold, and it has made my voice even more gravelly than usual. Special show tonight. It links up nicely with the next show that's going to be recorded as well, and I think all will be revealed over the next couple shows what I mean by that. But a special note to thank the producer, the woman behind the scenes, Amanda, who is doing all the hard work of connecting up the show, putting things together, working with my guests, working out how we're going to put our pictures together, the videos together, and making this a quality production. So we refer to her in our sidecar company of Polaris Productions as the guardian angel, and she definitely is. She does a great job. So thank you, Amanda, and the greatest audience on the planet. On their behalf, I thank you as well. I'd like to start the shows out with God's peace that surpasses all knowledge and understanding. And this show tonight is special because of the absolute wonderful work done by the writer, Steve Snyder. It's called Shot Down. And Shot Down is his incredibly well-detailed and hard work documenting his dad's shooting down in a B-17 during World War II on the French-Belgian border. It's an incredible story because he weaves in the incredible wartime action with the history and the understanding of what was going on in the world, and specifically the path that his dad and many, many other Americans took, men and women, to Europe, the theater of operations for World War II. He also does an incredible post-action closeout of all the things that went on and the people, and tying together the kind of human kind of bonds that were created. And I just was really captivated by the story. He's also an incredibly patient man because we had so many starts and fits with my crazy schedule to get this together. So I know it's going to be worth it. And once again, we're getting ready to welcome Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down, on Eagle's Wings. Well, Steve, welcome to On Eagle's Wings. It's wonderful to finally get together to talk about this incredibly detailed and what I consider extremely well-written and written with a lot of empathy and love that I was really impressed with. So thank you for taking my invite and working through all the crazy slots and turns that we took to finally get together.
Well, it's great to be here. I appreciate your interest, and we made it work.
I appreciate it as much. So this is a tremendous effort in my mind. And I say that because the detail in the book is extremely well done. It is very well cross-referenced. And your tie-ins for the whole epic that you have here is not the average read. You know, generally someone will concentrate on maybe the technical aspects of an aircraft, or they'll talk about the crew and how they flew things together. But you put the whole piece together. You were able to take the history leading up to this for your dad as he approached the tumultuous times of the late 30s that were really coming to a peak, right? Post-Depression era type advances that are finally happening, and then the world is going crazy. It's going to the point of really a no no sane, no happy ending. We knew what we were headed into. And your dad seemed to have taken on pretty quickly that he knew where this was heading. Am I correct in that kind of assessment?
Yeah, my dad was always very patriotic. And well, like most people at that time, you know, they answered the call. You know, not only the men that went into service, but everyone back home trying to support the war effort. Because, like as you mentioned, you know, they were tough people. They went through the Depression. They knew hard times, and they were ready for the fight.
So, what drew you to put this down to paper? Obviously, growing up with your dad, you're learning about this story. But I mean, what finally turned the switch on that you went and I mean, for 300 some odd pages that's in this book, there isn't a lot of wasted time in this book, which for my kind of reading, I appreciate. People take me, if I want to read a novel and we're going to explore some kind of philosophical struggle of man, those are there and I'll appreciate that. But there is a lot packed in these 300 plus 12 pages and annotated and detailed and pictured. What got you on this? What was the driving force?
Okay. Well, as far as my writing style, I'll mention that. I was not I was in sales and sales management for 40 years. I had no writing background or training. I was kind of like to write stuff, you know, marketing material, things like that. So I kind of write like I talk. I don't waste a lot of words. I kind of just get to the point and say what I want to say. You know, on some books it takes a whole page to say it's a sunny day. I just say the sun's out, you know. So it flows like that. I'm glad you appreciated that. But as far as how I came to write the book, it wasn't until I retired and from my career job that I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material about the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and learn a few more details. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. This absolutely riveting. He should have been a writer. And the other were all the letters that my dad wrote to my mother while he was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force before he was shot down. And my dad was really candid in these letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the airbase, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And I just became fascinated with the story, and it became my passion. And I started doing all this research, and I read book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I found members or relatives of all my dad's crew members and asked them for whatever information or pictures they could send to me. Started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told. So I decided to write a book.
Now, was your dad still with you when you started to write this book?
No, unfortunately, my dad, he wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91. He died in 2007, and I didn't decide to write the book until 2012. So unfortunately, I mean, it would have been, I can't believe how wonderful it would have been if he could go on these, you know, book signings with me and have him actually tell the stories, you know, right from the horse's mouth instead of me conveying what I've learned.
Well, I am sure that he smiles down from heaven, and I wouldn't be surprised that if he travels with you when you do the tours and do the book signings.
Amen to that. Yeah,
I say that with a lot of appreciation, because whatever the bond that you two have, that hasn't ended, and it comes out in the book. Now, I'm going to ask you one quick question. You talk about the letters, and I have a two-part on this, because obviously letter writing kind of went out. I think you and I are fairly close in age. I remember the nuns teaching me how to properly annotate and set up a letter. I mean, and you were supposed to write, you know, in a specific kind of format that, you know, recorded locations, dates, locations sometimes. You were supposed to make sense in each paragraph. You were supposed to have an opening and a conclusion, even if it was a short, you know, item. And if it was a short item, it was a note. So when I look at histories, especially military histories, and there are letters in this, another interesting group of people that I've read letters in the past were mathematicians, and how they were explaining the mathematical process that they were putting into an equation. Amazing. I mean, you know, pages and pages to explain operations that they were putting together. So the art of letter writing is gone for the most part. And our emails don't really reflect the same level. I'm not saying that they're worse or better, but from a detail point, you don't usually have a hard copy record in today's world that we live in, which is unfortunate. And we've moved much more into the video, especially the clip. I mean, by God, the nature of how we're doing this show, right? I mean, that's how we're entering into a lot of people's thought processes, by talking and showing pictures of this, and they're going to follow up the same way. Very few folks will probably go past getting your book, which I urge everyone to do. It's an excellent read, but that's kind of a different part of the culture, and I think it reflects in how they conducted themselves. So what do you think of that? Much too lengthy of me getting into that, but what do you think of that?
Oh yeah, it's like you say, it's a lost art, writing, you know, cursive. No one does that anymore. But you know, that's the way they had to communicate, you know, back then. You know, they could send a telegram, you know, Western Union telegram, but that was about it. You're not able to call anyone. You know, there's no social media or anything like that, which you were mentioning. And so the only way they could communicate is through letter writing. And both my dad and my mother wrote a lot. My mother was a school teacher. She's a history teacher, actually. And my dad was a voracious reader all his life. So my dad, he had an amazing vocabulary. He'd come up with, you know, he'd be talking to me and he'd say these big, you know, 8-syllable words. And I go, how do you know that word? You know, where did that come from? But he read so much that he didn't go to college, but from reading so much, he had a fantastic vocabulary.
Well, now you're going to make me make the comment that I make often. I have seen the test that you had to take to graduate the 8th grade. Most people couldn't pass that test. The era that these folks live in, a high school education in this, you know, in the North American continent, was completely different than it is today for life skills. Now, to be fair, yes, culturally we have changed. There's a lot more going on, but we have missed a very important founding that you and I probably are the last folks to have the end result of that. Because I had the same kind of drill probably up to about the time I entered high school. And then high school really started to expand that out. It was much more of a junior college kind of experience than it was high school of what that was. But those skill sets produced people that could build these aircraft, build ships, homes, societies. And a college degree was not a criticality. It was not a demand. It generally meant that you were going to a certain kind of profession. And of course, World War II melded and mixed all that together. But I always have to make that comment when I look back. My maternal grandfather, 6th grade education, voracious reader, but he had to go to work for his family. This is probably more of the 20s era leading up to the Depression. Machinist, one point of his life, read all the time, had the skill sets and had the aptitude to do that. And nowadays, we just wouldn't be able to reproduce that. We should be able to with the tools we have, but we do not. So I sorry for that quick aside. But I think that's important because of the way you lace in the cultures of the United States, of Europe, what is happening that leads to this intersection of all these people, and all these people that end up on this B-17 named after your mother, correct?
My sister, my oldest
Oh,
sister.
excuse me, your sister.
Yeah, she was 1 year old at the time my dad went overseas. So Susan Ruth was the name of the plane, Susan Ruth Snyder. But my mother's name was Ruth. But he named it after of the B-17 had a 10-man crew. This is my dad's crew here. There's four officers that are kneeling on the lower left is my dad. He was the first pilot and as such the commander of the plane and the crew. And then going across, you have the other officers, the co-pilot, the navigator, and the bombardier. And then six enlisted men standing behind them were mainly gunners. Five of these guys came home, but five did not. So, you know, half the stories ended tragically and half of them ended happily. But three of the crew were married, three of the officers, but my dad was the only one that had a child. Susan Ruth, and that's how the plane got named. But I was
Now,
getting, you know, talking about the today, and I find that, you know, back when we were younger, people really had an interest in history. I love history, but today, it seems like the younger generations just don't have that big of interest in history. You know, it's more techie stuff, you know, with computers or, you know, social media and. And you know, today there's so many jobs that are service jobs as opposed to, you know, back pre-war, you know, there weren't many, you know, everyone, a lot of manufacturing was what we did and farming is what we did because the US was much more of a rural country back then. A lot of those guys who went overseas had never even been out of their home county. And then all of a sudden half, you know, they're all halfway around the world fighting a war.
So let's touch upon that in history. Now, your mom teaches history, so I think that's where you probably learned a little bit about the discipline of history. I mean, that's a pretty strong influence. It appears to me that you're probably another avid reader, since you talked about how you got into this with your dad's and your parents' files, that you got, and now you delve into it, and now you're getting ready. Because you know what's ahead, you're going to take on creating this book. I noticed that the youngest folks coming of age, people that I still live in that world where if you're 18, you're an adult, since you're still allowed to get married and enter into contracts. So I'll use that, but I'm finding that crowd, 18 to early 20s, seems to be returning to a really strong interest in history. And it wouldn't surprise me that your book and others like it will start to capture the attention. Now, I think the interesting and it kind of is a self-fulfilling prophecy here. You're using all the right technology out there to get the story out. You have videos. We're going to have one towards the end of this first session that we're going to do. It's the documentary on the book. When we do the show tonight, we're going to have clips and small segments that are going to be cut out and packaged through. A really talented content creator that that I use on the show, Chanel. She's phenomenal at this kind of work, and she understands it. And often, when it's a really good topic, I expect she's going to come back and say how good this one is, that she really enjoyed this one. So, I think though that the scariest part of this is, and I can't believe we're already talking about AI, but it seems to permeate our world. If you have a lack of history, you're not going to pick up when things start to, if they don't repeat, in the words of Mark Twain, rhyme. Okay. And I think we have a lot of rhyming going on when just recently I heard that an AI program broke out of its confines of a created, I think they were calling it the sandbox, I think is the term that they use. So they created some kind of computer environment for it to remain, and it figured how to get out. And it went off and caused trouble. Now, if you haven't read and you don't know anything about history, that may seem novel and new. It's as old as the Old Testament, for goodness sakes, right?
You mentioned AI. over the years, well, not over the years, but within the last couple of years, I found three books pop up on Amazon, which are about my dad and his story, which are AI written, They're just real short, bunch of, mistakes, just
Sure.
crappy work that I had taken down. And then just a couple weeks ago, I came across a 22-minute AI movie made by a guy in Poland. It's all AI, about my dad and his story. And I had YouTube take that down because, it was totally copyright infringement.
Right.
So it permeates everything.
It does. And I obviously it's a useful tool in my day job. I use it more than I ever expected I would. It's an incredible resource for getting it. But if you don't go back and check it, it's just like if you read this book, if we read your book, and you don't take the time, you won't know the accuracy of the kind of work that you did. Now, to be fair, your book has a completeness to it that lacks most of the stuff that comes out more modern with, details and references and going back, all those natty little details that were such a big part of our lives growing up. It seems to have been a little bit maybe blushed over nowadays with this. But think about the fact that you had two people make an AI book based on this. Now, that could be nothing more than looking at book sales, getting the names, running it through AI, and then, doing a quick electronic print, selling it for, pennies that they'll sell it for. But it does tell me that someone had to find that, and they had to find it for a reason, because there's some kind of interest in it. And I'm sure it used an algorithm to figure that out.
The AI movie that was made, the 22-minute movie, it was pretty good. That cost them some money to make that. But it's gone now.
But it infringed. It may have been good and they spent some money, but they didn't spend the right money to get the rights to go do that.
No. Because they sent me emails saying how sorry they were and everything. And, please forgive them and blah, blah, blah. But they knew what they were doing.
They probably did. And I'm sure in your heart that you did forgive them as things got straightened out. That's only fair. So we're coming up kind of close to our break. Let's talk a little bit about this short documentary video that we're going to play as we lead into the break, and we'll pick up our conversation on these sites. What are we going to look at in this coming up?
Well, I made two trips. Well, I've been to Belgium 8 times doing research and attending ceremonies. And on two of the trips, I went with my youngest son, Clayton, and we had film guys with us that we filmed just hours and hours and hours of footage because I was thinking about making a full-length documentary. But then that just got to be too big of a project and too expensive. So we decided to make a short film. My son has a lot of friends in the entertainment industry. So we had a guy we just gave all this material to, and he put together this 13-minute video, which I saw it for the first time and was shocked. It's pretty good. And a lot of it's an interview that I did here at my home with lots of pictures. So it turned out pretty good and gives a pretty good overview of me writing the book and the story itself and some of the people that I got to know.
Well, excellent. Let's run that. We'll go to break and we're going to pick up the discussion. My guest here is Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down, the story of the Susan Ruth B-17 Flying Fortress during World War II and the European Theater of Operations.
Like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war. Growing up, I knew the basics. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. His plane was named the Susan Ruth. He flew bombing missions over occupied Europe. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down. I had a wonderful relationship with my father. He was a tough guy, you know, kind of a no-nonsense guy. We compared him to John Wayne. He was that type of character. My parents grew up in an area with tough times. They went through the Depression, and they were tough people as a result of that. World War II came along, and there was no other event in history that affected more people. When Japan bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, the country rallied. They believed in their cause, and they were willing to sacrifice all to achieve victory. Flying combat was incredibly dangerous. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was 6. For these guys to keep going up, you know, on mission after mission, knowing that the next one could be their last, took a lot of bravery and a lot of guts.
I got shot down on my 8th mission. I was up in the air, and 2 phone calls came in, and they shot the heck out of us. They came in about 1 o'clock. They just made one pass, and everything blew up. 2 of my men were killed in the plane. 2 evaded capture. I was one of them, and my tail gunner was the other. And then 3 of them got down safely, but they were picked up by the Germans, and they were interrogated, and then they were marched out into the woods and shot in the back of the head. 3 Belgian farmers saw the chute open, and they came running over, and they threw me a rope, pulled me up to the tree, and got me out of the tree. And one of them took me off into the woods and hid me. They were different personalities, of course. Some of them were brave, some of them were scared to death. The ones that were scared of hiding you, they'd move you pretty quick. The ones that weren't scared, I mean, you might stay there 6 weeks.
They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends. If the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they'd be arrested, tortured, and either sent to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people that helped my dad and his other members of the crew met that fate. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on June 6th. So he knew they'd be coming up through France to liberate that area. His Belgian helpers accompanied him over the Belgian border into France and joined up with a unit of the French resistance called the Mackie. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, attack convoys, assassinate German officers. And so he fought with them for a couple months.
The very first hours of the 2nd of September 1944, few jeeps of the reconnaissance party of the 60th Infantry Regiment crossed the border, and there the Belgian population were waiting for the liberators. They were waiting there for 4 long years, and they saw the liberators coming in, and they were waving, they had flowers. It was very happy days for all people of Belgium.
Word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into the village, into the town square, up to an army major. My dad identified himself, and that ended his 7 months of missing in action. The Belgian people saw firsthand the atrocities committed by the Nazis. To this day, they are so grateful and so thankful still for the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from Nazi oppression.
My father, Paul Delahaye, started the Belgian-American Foundation in 1984. It was for the 40th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. The GIs who had been killed deserved the right to be honored and to receive homage from us because they gave their life for us.
Every year they have ceremonies at these various memorials that they've erected in the area on the anniversary date of those events. But the big celebrations are always on September 2nd, the anniversary date of the liberation of Belgium.
Your father came the first time in 1988. I remember him when he came the first time because we were very young. So that was the Americans. We had never seen Americans, you know? So that was a bit crazy.
In 1994, I took my first trip to Belgium with my parents. There was an event. There were hundreds of people in this hall, and we were a little late arriving. My dad walked in, and the entire place stood up and started applauding. And it was really moving. You know, they treated him like he was the president of the United States. I'll never forget it. And I got a whole new appreciation for my dad because, you know, I knew these stories, but, you know, you hear the stories, but, you know, they're not that personal to you. But when you're there and you've seen these places where the events took place, been in rooms where my dad was hidden. He was right here. He climbed out this window to get up on this roof. And the history is preserved right there.
The locals really saved my dad's life.
It's a war we fought together. He came here to liberate my country. Why wouldn't I help him?
I corresponded with him from the time I got back to the States until he died. They're wonderful people. They're brave people. I mean, they risk their life to keep you from being captured.
My parents had kept a lot of material from the war. There were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action. And the other item were all the letters that my dad wrote to my mother during the war that she had kept. And sitting down one time, spending several hours reading these letters, and I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told. People needed to hear about it, and so I decided to write a book. Shot Down focuses on one crew and what happened to each member of that crew. That it just makes for a fascinating story, one that hasn't been told. All that the U.S. military knew was that my dad's plane was shot down by two Focke-Wulf German fighters, and I just assumed that's all I'd ever know. One day, during my research, my wife Glenda said, "Why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot him down?" But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. He's 95 years old now. He lives in Munich, Germany.
Here's a picture of Hans.
This is a picture of...
Well, that's pretty neat. That's your plane, your picture, yeah, and your autograph.
The young people of today, they have no idea what our life was, what the time was, what difficulties we had, and that we were not all evil Nazis, but we were people like you and me, and we just grew up in different spheres. On this 8th day of February, your father and me met, and we shot each other down.
I've been asked several times, like, well, don't you hate this guy that shot down your dad's plane? But no.
Well, good for you. It keeps...
From the very get-go, I felt a personal relationship with Hans. He was 20 years old. He was fighting for his country, just trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. And World War II was the defining moment in my father's life. Really, I think it's the defining moment for any guy's life who fought in World War II.
This... Yeah.
And Hans is a part of my dad's life, a part of his story. And so I had no ill feelings toward Hans, and we become friends.
Never thought that I'd meet the son of a guy I shot down.
Yeah, well, I never thought I'd meet you either.
Incredible.
I know the facts, but more want to know the why or how he felt, because I never asked him about it until it was too late.
Miss him?
Yes, I do. He was a great man. It's too bad that I didn't do all this while he was still living.
We had a deep respect for the American troops who came and helped us. We know that if they didn't, the world wouldn't be the same today. I'm trying to do now the same with my kids. So I'd like them to learn about that, and first to learn respect towards the Americans who came and did it and sacrificed for us.
I do think that we own them liberty. It's the less we can do. It's try to make sure they will never be forgotten.
As World War II fades in the memory of people lose sight of what took place, what that generation fought for, because you know the old expression, if you don't learn from history, you're going to repeat it. They say that for a reason. So it gives you appreciation for your freedom and maybe a better appreciation for the people that serve, and gives a better appreciation and value for your country. So that's really one of the reasons why I do what I do, is to try to keep the memory alive.
Well, Steve, I must have seen that documentary now close to 10 times. I've lost track. Such a great encapsulation of everything you did there. And I think it fits, and it's very fitting to the book, because it's a good companion to the book. And if anyone sees that and thinks any part of it is interesting, they definitely need to take the time to read the book. And it won't be a long time to read it. You will get through this book fast. It's, as Steve said in the first half, he writes the way he speaks, and it's well done, and it's extremely readable, and you want to get through it, and it's written in a way that does. It's a good sales pitch. So I guess you were probably a successful salesperson and in the sales world, and I suspected you were probably leading sales forces just based on your background and the way you talk. So let me run through a couple quick spots. Let's get some spot stuff in here. One, the B-17, your dad's opinion of that airplane, probably one of the most consequential aircraft that we built, built in the 30s, Boeing Aircraft Corporation. What was your dad's opinion of the airplane? Although he didn't get to fly it very long, he did have a very demanding training period to get him into that aircraft.
Yeah, he had a lot of flight time in the B-17, because even when they went to England, they continually practiced flying and flying in formation. So he got to know that plane really well. He loved it. Any guy that flew a B-17 loved it. It was nicknamed a Flying Fortress because it had 13.50 caliber machine guns. Put out a tremendous amount of firepower. This is what a 50 millimeter shell looks like. It's pretty deadly. And the thing about it too, it could take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep flying. These bombers would get just beat up on these missions. You know, they'd lose, their engines would go out, you know, hydraulics, and some of these bombers would come back to England looked like they'd be so beat up and so many holes in them, it looked like they could hardly fly. So that saved a lot of airmen's lives, bringing them back after taking so much damage during these bomb runs.
I've spoken now to a number of folks connected with the B-17. Amazing airplane.
It's amazing. It's, you know, they look pretty big from the outside, but if you've never been inside one, it's more cramped than a submarine. You just got to crawl around a lot to get some places. You have to be on your hands and knees and get right there. You need to be pretty limber to go through those things.
Yeah, it is a big airplane, but it was designed to carry a big bomb load and a lot of fuel.
Yep. And on some of those, the 8th Air Force was nicknamed the Mighty 8 because of the number of bombers they could put up on missions, which numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin, Germany. I mean, you can't even imagine 2,000 bombers. You know, that's like, I don't know, over 300 miles long of just bombers just going and bombing and bombing.
What was your dad's opinion of
especially
England?
Especially in the early years of the war. Flying. Well, he liked England. The people were very friendly. He liked going into London on when he'd get a pass, but that was, you know, one of the things that he said that's in the book. With the blackout in London, because trying to defend the city from German bombers, it was just pitch black. You couldn't see your way around, so you were bumping into stuff all the time. But he enjoyed those journeys, and that was one of the things that it was so fun reading his letters, because he would talk about, you know, passes or leaves that he and his buddies would have and what they did and some of the shenanigans they got into, which was, you know, reading those letters like my dad talking to me. And it was just incredible, the detail that he went into. That's really kind of set up my book, because I set up the book just to follow his letters, basically. You know, from the time, you know, well, I gave a little history about his growing up, but then, you know, after marrying my mother, then going through, he was in the infantry for a year before he got into the Air Force. His time there, his pilot training, the first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down. So it talks a lot about the history of air war, of flying combat missions, the B-17. And then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards. And it's not just about my dad, but it goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew and about all those courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them.
So I have two questions that I want to make sure we touch upon. Your dad and your understanding of what went on leading to this, what was your dad's take on strategic bombing, how we did precision daylight bombing, which put huge, huge burden on the American bombing force, because we did it during the day, the British did it at night. The British had to do area bombing because we didn't have the sophistication or the level of sophistication that we have now, obviously, for targeting. So we had the famous Norton bomb site, which was supposed to provide, you know, a great deal of accuracy, and it did under the right conditions. Unfortunately, not all combat conditions matched its abilities. What was your dad's take on that, especially after the war? I'm curious.
Okay. Well, yeah, like you say, the Norton bomb site was a revolutionary device. And, you know, when they were in training in the States before going over there, they would practice, you know, bombing, but they would only be flying a lot, like 5 or 10,000 feet. And, you know, a lot of these bases were down in Texas or the Southwest, where, you know, there's very little weather. You know, the visibility is, you know, you can see for miles, and you have no enemy fighters shooting at you or anti-aircraft fire. And so it was much more accurate. Even though, you know, they said they could drop a bomb in a pickle barrel, which wasn't the case. But once you got over to Germany, you know, it's overcast and, you know, Northern Europe, you know, most of the time. And so the cloud cover was such that you couldn't see the targets a lot of times very well. And then, you know, the weather, and you, then you have all those, in battle, you're flying in really tight formations.
Right.
I mean, the pilots had to really stay alert, or else they could clip a wing of the plane next to them or run into the bomber in front of them and go down. So, I mean, they had to, they had that stress, and then all the turbulence of not only the weather, but all those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. So the wake turbulence and the prop wash would just be churning things up, and then enemy fires firing at them, flak going off. So their bombing wasn't near as accurate over there. And that's one reason why they had to send up so many bombers, because the accuracy, you know, they needed to send so many planes to drop so many bombs to be effective back then.
Right.
But my dad was real proud of his service, you know, loved that plane. You know, he believed in strategic daylight bombing, unlike, you mentioned, the British, who bombed at night, and the carpet bombing, area bombing, to bomb cities to try to weaken the will of the German population. You know, whereas the 8th Air Force, you know, they tried to hit industrial and military targets to crippled Nazi Germany's ability to wage war, but there was definite collateral damage at times. But he was a strong proponent of it, and was proud of the job they did over there.
Next question. When you talk about elite groups and fraternities that are formed around it, the 8th Air Force, and they have a very nice museum in Georgia, right along I-95, for anybody who's in that part of the world ever, it's worth going there. I suspect your book is probably for sale in there from time to time, if not all the time. Talk a little to me about that community that's around your dad's squadron, the bomb group, and the 8th Air Force, because it's a very storied organization.
Yeah, the 8th Air Force, that was isolated, or not isolated, but in England, to bomb the Germany, the Nazis in occupied territories, and also in Germany. The 8th Air Force had three air divisions, and then each air division was comprised of air wings, and then air wings were comprised of bomb groups, and then bomb groups were comprised of bomb squadrons. So it was a very, you know, hierarchical organization. The 1st and 3rd Air Division flew B-17s, and the 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberators. My dad was in the 306th Bomb Group, which is based at Thurlow, England, about a little northwest of London by about 60 miles. And he was in the 369th Bomb Squadron, the Fightin' Bitin'. And that had a real good record. So when he found out he was going into the 369th, bomb squadron, he was pleased about that, because they set a record at the time. Prior to D-Day, they flew 43 missions, straight missions, without a loss. And that wasn't surpassed until after D-Day, when by that time the 8th Air Force, particularly the P-51 Mustangs, had just decimated the Luftwaffe. That's one thing, you know, they talk about D-Day and, you know, all these movies about D-Day, but there would never have been a D-Day without the 8th Air Force taking out the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, so that they could have that, the landing and invasion. Yeah, I, 2 years ago, I went over to Normandy. They finally put a monument to the 8th Air Force. I went over to the dedication ceremonies for that. Which was really cool.
So now let's talk about your dad joining the resistance. Obviously not a volunteer. He kind of dropped into the position, into the role, from his being shot down. I am really impressed with the way your dad conducted himself in this, that he gained trust, obviously made bonds with these people. But he even continued to fight, what I call a warrior's warrior, in that, that he, you know, exemplified what was really expected. And to this day, the same thing is expected. But your dad really picked that up and took that on and made it his own. Can you give us a little bit about those that time and talk about his time with the resistance and the people of Belgium?
Sure, sure. Well, after my dad bailed out, he was missing an act. Well, he parachuted down right at the French-Belgian border, and his parachute got hung up at some trees and the branches. And he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Devan, came to his rescue. And then after that, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there, and then how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. So he was moved around a lot. Normally, when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get him back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad in these networks. Oftentimes, they were compromised by infiltrators, German infiltrators, or members of the network were killed or captured. So that was very frustrating for him. And also, it was very stressful for him to be hiding because, you know, he almost got discovered, you know, several times, which are described in the book. And then word finally came that the Allies had landed at Normandy, and he knew the U.S. armies would be coming up through France. And that's when he decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, my dad had that years of training in the infantry, so he knew right. how to fight on the ground, unlike most airmen who had been in the army. And his Belgium helpers tried to talk him out of joining the French resistance because it was so dangerous. I mean, he could be killed fighting against the Germans, or if they captured him, he'd be shot on the spot as a spy, a traitor, a terrorist. But my dad thought, well, here, you know, there's Americans, you know, over there fighting, you know, risking their lives, trying to preserve freedom and defeat the Nazis. And so he thought it was his duty to get back in the fight. And I don't know how many people would have decided what he did, because the safest thing for him to do would just be stay hunkered down and in hiding until the U.S. forces came up and liberated the area. Here you see my dad with some of the Belgian people that helped him. This isn't the resistance group that my dad joined, but it gives you an idea of what they looked like. They were small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups all across France. And they were supplied by through airdrops by the British, and they were also given their information from the British. This is my dad, a picture of my dad in 1944 fighting with the French resistance. Who took this picture and how it ever got back to my dad, I'll never know. But another thing that's nice about the book, there's over 200 time period photographs, so you can visualize everything you're reading about, and many pictures taken by Belgian people, you know, during the war. And but my dad was insistent on joining up with the French resistance. So one of his helpers, Amy Cools, accompanied him on bicycles, and they went down to the French border, and he met up with a unit. Obviously, they were pretty suspicious of him at the beginning, because who's this guy? Because the resistance group was comprised of some Frenchmen, some Belgium, and some Algerians. It was led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. So he fought with, they taught him how to, you know, put together roadside bombs, and they had laid these bombs on the road. So when a convoy came by, the truck or the tank would hit it and explode, and then they'd start firing on him. And there's several encounters described in the book that my dad had with the Germans, which are pretty thrilling. So, and then finally, you know, 7 months after bailing out, a word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Treslon, France. So he walked into town and met up with an army major and hopped on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then got on a transport to get back to his base at London. So that was a pretty thrilling time. My dad, not only, you know, being shot down, because, you know, the number of guys that were shot down is limited to the whole 8th Air Force. And then the ones that evaded were even a smaller number than that. And the numbers that actually joined up with the French resistance to fight is pretty minuscule. So he had really an amazing, exciting experience, not only but being hiding by all these different Belgian people, but also fighting with the French resistance. He learned how to speak conversational French. One of the places he stayed for a long period of time, next door was a 16-year-old girl, Mimi Gabriel, who spoke English, and she would play cards with him and Monopoly and do crosswords. And he learned how to speak conversational French before he joined up with the French resistance. As you say, he stayed in touch with many people that helped him, for the rest of their lives. And he made a few trips back to Belgium to meet with him. And I was fortunate to meet a couple of his helpers on my first trip I took to Belgium with my folks.
So, Steve, here's the next kind of series of questions. Your dad's meeting with the major in France and repatriating. And then when he gets back to his unit in England, I'm curious if you had any key remarks that he ever passed on to you, because I have to imagine those had to be two very tumultuous moments of, getting back to American lines and then his eventual return back to his unit, and all the things that changed there. Anything on that?
Yeah, he said when he got back, he hardly knew anyone because, those combat crews would rotate in after you finish so many missions, you could get to go home. But there was only a few officers that were still there that he knew. When he got back to England, he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother because he was shot down on February 8th. My mother got a Western Union telegram on February 23rd saying that he was missing in action. So she didn't know if she'd ever see him again or not. 7 months had passed by, but he sent a Western Union telegram that said, back at base, fit as a fiddle, bank the money, honey, because he had all that back pay coming from all those months missing in action, and then we'll write soon. So that had to be a glorious day, probably the best day of my mother and my grandparents' life when they heard that he was safe. Because she was back home not only with Susan, who was 1 year old, but while my dad was missing in action, my mother had my other sister, Nancy, so she's got a 1 year old and an infant, never knowing if she might be a widow pretty soon.
Amazing.
And then they had a rule back then that if you were shot down and aided by the underground, that you couldn't go back into combat. Because they were worried if you were shot down a second time and captured by the Germans and tortured, that you'd give up the identity of the people that helped you the first time. The only exception to that rule was Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into letting him go back into combat. So they sent my dad back home, and then he became a flight instructor, B-17 flight instructor for the remainder of the war.
Now let's talk about his return and your family's return back to Belgium. I think that it's shown in the video that we had on earlier, great pictures in the book, but I'm curious for your insights with that, because if I'm remembering correctly, he didn't immediately return. There's a little bit of time before he went back.
Yeah, I think the first time he went back was like 1970. Then he went back a couple other times and met with some of his helpers. And then in 1988, he got a letter from a Dr. Paul Delahaye, who had formed in 1984 the Belgium American Foundation to remember and honor these Americans that helped liberate his country. Because he was just a small boy during the war and was greatly affected by it. And he became a local historian, and he got my dad's name from one of my dad's helpers. And so he invited him over to this ceremony to dedicate this monument to the first 12 GIs that were killed in the liberation of Belgium. And my dad never heard of this guy before. And he's talking with my mother. My mother like, well, should we go to this or not? And then shortly after that, he was sent another letter, and it had the program of the event, which listed my dad as the keynote speaker. So he goes, well, I guess we have to go now, Ruth. So in 1988, my dad went over with one of his waist gunners, And then the next year, 1989, they erected a memorial to my dad and his crew. And my dad went over with the three other crewmen who were still living at the time and their wives. And there my dad was reunited with all these Belgian people. That's the memorial there in Mackinac, right north of the French border. And when he went back there, my dad was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war, revisited these places where he stayed, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it after that. And then in 5 years later, in 1994, for the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and my dad's plane being shot down, my wife and I went over with my parents to that. And that's when it became personal for me, because my, you know, so I saw this stuff firsthand. You know, my dad, you know, the farm where the French resistance group stayed, other houses where he was hidden in, and other places where the shot down story took place. And it's amazing, because this is southern Belgium is all rural countryside. It hasn't changed in hundreds of years. So all these places are still there today, where you can go and see where, you know, history was made and where the shot down story took place and so much action occurred.
I just absolutely cannot say enough about the absolute quality and intriguing story that's in Shot Down, because it just does not you know, go to the geeks like me who just want to talk about airplanes and the flying and the tactics. It has that, and it is very well balanced and very well done, but it's unique to find a book that will put together a really complete story. It traces through so wonderfully. And I'm so happy that, you know, your dad got contacted and you were able to make that final trip over with him to see that. And it lit the fire in you to do this. Now, I'm going to ask, is there any other projects that are coming up? Because I know you do a lot of work with the history of his bomb group. Do you have anything else in mind?
Well, I keep pretty busy. I'm, excuse me, president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Association, and I'm on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. And then I travel all around the country going to air shows, signing copies of my book. I just came back from Michigan, Thunder Over Michigan, where I signed copies there. And I do a lot of PowerPoint presentations to all sorts of groups. So I I'm active, you know, promoting the book still on social media. So it's writing that book changed my life. Here I was retiree. I wrote that book and it started a whole new career for me, which is more of a hobby and a love. But I love doing it, you know, keep the memory alive, you know, not only my dad and his crew, but the whole 8th Air Force and the history of World War II. When I wrote my book, I didn't want it to appeal just to, you know, history buffs or World War II buffs. I wanted to appeal to, you know, the general population and, you know, even, you know, women as well as men. So I had that in mind when I wrote the book. And when I tried to put a lot of little anecdotes about it that would kind of interest. My wife said one of the things she liked or learned was what a GI, you know, stood for, where that came from.
Right.
And there's lots of little things like that that's in the book. But I have signed an option purchase agreement to make the book into a movie. Whether that'll happen, you know, we'll see. But that would be awful cool if it is.
Well, are we going to produce it and shoot it in Poland, or is that off the table?
No, this is all US based by
I couldn't end this without saying that this book screams to be a movie. It really does, because there's just so much there that can be done so well. And again, as you said, the book is, although someone like me who's pretty geekish when it comes to this kind of military history, especially aviation, is drawn to this. Even if you never were interested, but if you're a student in college or high school and you want to get an understanding of what the war in Europe during World War II was, This is an easy way to get a deep dive and be exposed to so much of it. So I think it's a great honor to your mom's history teaching skills, because she either passed it on to you by lesson or DNA or both. And I can't say enough about really how well and why people should pick this up. It's summertime. We're happening to be doing this. If someone's looking for a good summer read, this is a one to pick up. It's a wonderfully well done book. You made a remark, and I'm going to kind of end the show on this and give you final remarks. In your video, you said your dad, he was a great man. And I'm going to say you are as well. Considering you carried on the tradition so well and you did so nicely, a tribute to him and his crew and his squadron and the group, and then ultimately, you know, the wing and the division going all the way up to the 8th Air Force. And it's just tremendous. And I am so happy that the fire got lit in you. So, Steve, I'll give you final words.
Well, I appreciate that a lot. That's very, very kind of you. That last picture that you put up there was, my dad wanted to go to visit the World War II Memorial before he died. And we went, I accompanied him on a trip to attend Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society. And we went to the memorial right before its official dedication. And that was the last trip he ever took. That was in 2004. And then 3 years later, he passed away. So that was a very special trip. I'll never forget that. And that's really the point of what I do, is to never forget. My tagline, it's our duty to remember. I sign that in every one of my books. They were the greatest generation. There was no event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, million more were left displaced and homeless. Millions more were wounded. It changed the course of the U.S. and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died to preserve freedom, like I said, to be without a doubt the greatest generation. And this is why I do what I do, trying to keep that memory alive.
Well, simply outstanding, Steve. Thank you so much for, as I said at the beginning of the show, working through all the silly little hoops that I unfortunately set up to get us together, but it was absolutely worth it for me. I know the greatest audience on the planet will truly enjoy it, and all those that do it. And as I said when we were getting ready for the show, I'm hoping with another interview that I'll be doing very soon, again on a B-17 and a B-17 crew, I'm going to try to get the three of us together, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun to have the three of us in the room talking about this. So again, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. It was a wonderful show, and I really appreciate the hard work and your continued faithful effort to never forget. It really is truly an honor to have spoken with you, and thank you for coming on Eagle's Wings.
Well, thank you very much. I had a great time being on the show. I really appreciate it. God bless.
God bless you as well, sir. Thank you, folks. Stand by for another episode on Eagle's Wings as soon as I can get the recording. Remember, it's not Amanda's fault, it's mine. Talk to you soon.